aviation, heavy transport, and industry are amongst the hardest sectors to electrify. To decarbonize these sectors, we need clean fuels that work within existing systems and engines. Biofuels offer promising solutions. TNO, in collaboration with European partners, is at the forefront of developing advanced biofuels. How sustainable are these biofuels? Can they lead us to cleaner mobility, or will their application remain limited to specific cases? I have two guests in the studio. Loes Knotter is Executive Director at Platform Renewable Fuels. And Berend Vreugdehil is Gasification Specialist at TNO. Great to have you both here in the studio. Let's first make sure that we know what we are talking about. What are biofuels, Berend?
Biofuels are fuels that are made from a biological origin. So residues from the pulp and paper industry, from forest activities, from agricultural activities, they can all be transformed into fuels via digestion, gasification, pyrolysis. And then these fuels, they are called biofuels.
All right. Okay. So now we understand what it is and also what the feedstock is about. Loes, the electrification of aviation, heavy transport and industry is very hard to do. Why is it so hard? Why can't we just fly on electricity?
Well, that currently, I think they are working on it, but currently if you take a large plane, that would mean you bring a lot of batteries and then you cannot bring people or goods on the plane. So that's exactly why they need high-density energy carriers, and that's, in fuels currently.
Yeah. So it's all about the combination of the density of the energy and the weight that you need to, in case of a plane, to get it up in the air.
Absolutely. And you heard me saying at the moment, they're looking at new models, they are looking at electrification, but then mostly in the short term, smaller in airplanes.
All right. All these things, so aviation, heavy transport, and industry, they're all very investment heavy. So you don't buy a plane and trade it in 2 years for another model that's a bit better. So why is it so interesting then to see how you can fit a different kind of fuel that has a different source into these systems?
You're not fitting in a different kind of fuels. You're fitting in a fuel of a different origin, but with the same properties.
It is the same.
It's the same. So for aviation, there's very specific standards which you have to comply with. Mm-hmm. And if you make a fuel from biomass and you comply with the standards, then everyone knows you can use the fuel. It will behave exactly the same as a fuel from a fossil origin. So that means that you don't have to change anything in your existing infrastructure, in your equipment. You can just reuse what you have, but with a renewable fuel.
Okay, wow. So a very large market, I would say, Loes.
Yes, true. However, it's not just a large market as such. The new fuels will be more expensive. So you get them in the market, well, at least in Europe, with mandates. You just say, well, at least on your total, you need to have this percentage renewable fuels. This is the way they are getting to the market. Would those new fuels be more and less expensive than fossil? Then I think that then the engine of the market will go and help these in deployment.
Yeah. So at the moment, it is just a percentage that's been mixed in, because if it's the same, then you don't have to keep the sources separated, you would say.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's exactly, I think, but I'm not an expert on how much, but I think it's 50% for aviation, which you are allowed to blend in as long as you comply with the standards.
Okay.
That's the standard. And the percentage that is now mandated is 2%.
It's at the moment.
At the moment. And as a platform renewable fuels, we think that's too low. The industry can have already high, it can already supply a higher mandate on higher mandates.
Okay. So what would you suppose, what would you like it to be?
Higher mandates.
Higher mandates. Yeah. Yeah. So the problem is not that there's not enough. Because you can also say, well, 2% of, because 2% doesn't sound like much, but if it's 2% of a lot, then you still need a lot of biofuels to produce. But that's not the problem. There's enough
the industry is ready to produce, okay. And 2% is actually a too low mandate. The industry for aviation fuels, yeah, let's be precise here then, the industry can supply more, a larger amount of fuels.
Yeah.
Sorry for this English.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. What is the difference in price at the moment? Because you said, Luz, that the biofuels at the moment are more costly than normal kerosene in the case of airplanes. What's the price difference? Is it just a percentage or is it like twice as much?
No, I would say it's a bit less than twice as much, but it's in that range for the biofuel. You can also produce an aviation fuel from electricity, and then it's maybe three times as much as the current kerosene in the plane.
Yeah.
So wouldn't you be mandated? You would not choose for a renewable fuel cost-wise.
Yeah.
You would do it climate-wise, but not cost-wise.
All right. Berend, because let's make sure that we understand the difference. We're talking about biofuels. We also made a podcast about e-fuels. What's the difference between the two?
An e-fuel is a fuel that is made from CO2. So you have CO2 that you can take from the air, with direct air capture or from point sources. So in flue gases, in industrial applications. And then you combine that with hydrogen from produced from electricity to produce aviation fuel. And then you talk about an e-fuel. Okay. You can also make e-methane and you can also make e-methanol. The origin is a CO2 source combined with hydrogen.
All right. And hopefully then a green energy source.
Yeah. The hydrogen is green. Yeah. So renewable electricity. Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of debate about bio materials as being a feedstock for energy consumption. What would you say about that? Because when is a biofuel truly sustainable, Luz?
It's sustainable because of a lot of criteria that we think are necessary to require. So we have a whole sustainability system that actually asks for all kind of criteria. You cannot go into the rainforest there, that's, or use these kinds of, that's prohibited. So it's actually the requirements are strict. And only on basis of these requirements, you can enter as a sustainable biofuel at the market. And that makes biofuels, whatever origin, sustainable because it follows these sustainability criteria.
Okay, so there are very strict criteria that you have to meet for the feedstock to get into a biofuel.
Yes, that's right.
All right. Because, of course, the debate is, are we producing... biomaterials that we use for energy instead of that we're producing food. So there's a competition between these two. That's normally the discussion that's going on.
Yeah, I think that's from errors from the past, maybe, where you've seen some things go wrong with when these criteria were not that strict or didn't exist. And that's also one of the reasons why there's so much animosity or fear of producing biofuels from certain groups in society because they think, well, they're cutting down rainforest or they will destroy the land or you will have more emissions, etc. Which I don't think that's true, but the fear is leading rather than the science in this case.
Yeah.
And well, that's a problem because that doesn't drive the market. If you want to invest in a biofuel plant, but you know that there's a lot of resistance coming from society if you do this, why would you do it as a company?
Yeah. And is there enough feedstock?
There is plenty of feedstock. There's been estimations. Well, every year they recalculate these estimations. And if you look about the total energy consumption worldwide, the average sums up to about 30% can be supplied through biomass.
30%?
30%.
Wow.
So residues. And then if you would only focus on producing fuels, then... Yeah, for the coming decades, you will have plenty of fuels because the market to produce biofuels is not that big. There is some biofuel produced from sugars, mainly in the US and Brazil from ethanol from sugars. Mm-hmm. There's some methane being produced through digestion, but that's roughly it. And then all the residues from forestry activities, from agricultural activities, from crop burning in the field, all those residues are not used currently. So there's a huge potential.
What happens with it now, with all these residues from?
Well, in certain countries they still have crop burning in the field. So there's a lot of emissions there, particulates, toxic materials going into the atmosphere, but also CO2, or is left to rot in the forest. You see, good forest management would also help to reduce the risk of forest fires. But if you leave everything in the forest and it's a dry season, then you have a lot of fuel, yeah, which could be a biofuel, but a lot of fuel which, if it catches fire, will cause a lot of problems.
So I would say investing in biofuels, scaling up in biofuels, will also diminish some other problems, because there you will create a bigger market for farmers in all countries to do something with their residual waste.
Yeah, it can generate benefits on both sides. So there's a lot of residues in Asian and African countries, which if you could utilize it to be used in Europe to produce biofuels, or you can produce it over there, you mm-hmm. generate more value in the country themselves, then it would build up the economy there. You don't burn the residues in the field, and you provide biofuels to the European market, where I think need is the largest.
Yeah. Luce, big question with every podcast we make, with everything that we're talking about, the energy transition and even the sustainable transition that we're in, how can we speed up? How can we scale up? What's needed?
Yeah, I'm going to say again, these same mandates. I think the sector is ready. We can supply on higher mandates. So I think mandates are very helpful. We can see it here in the Netherlands. From 2023 to 2024, the sector has delivered 47% more renewable fuels in 1 year time to the market. It's the working of mandates. Mm. So I think mandates are very helpful. It gives also a path to every year. If you increase the mandate every year, you get a very reliable path. You know what's going to do. You can invest on that. It is de-risking. So mandates is helping. And as a platform, we are also saying not just mandates, we should also really limit the use of fossil. It's that combination that would be.
And is it then CO2
good.
Pricing?
That's helpful. Okay. That's helpful. So and the ETS, I think, is an extremely helpful instrument. And I think if we would keep this path that we is now proposed in the emission trade system, we need to have actually, we won't have fossil fuels in the system anymore by 2043 is basically tomorrow. So if you then say what is needed to accelerate mandates, ETS is helping, and then we need investments. And basically we say the technique has reached so high, such high technology readiness levels, that's also ready. Yeah. So we basically need investments, higher mandates, and we can deliver.
All right. Berend, what role does TNO play in the speeding up and scaling up of the use of biofuels?
TNO is very good at developing technology to TRL level 5-6, so the technology readiness level. So that's lab scale, pilot scale units.
Do you have an example of what still has to be developed on a technical level?
On a technical level, I don't think the developments are per se needed. As Lou said, the technique is ready. We've seen demonstration plans that ran successfully, but then the financial requirements were not good enough. So eventually they stopped operating because there's no business case. So that needs to be in place first, but a lot of technique is ready. But the first investment for a plant, for a first of a kind plant, requires a lot of capex, a lot of investment up front. And if you then run into issues, you also need to have sufficient funds to solve these issues. And mm-hmm. any type of technology that you build for the first time will have issues. And there's some examples over the past years where people built plants of up to $1 billion. US dollar, for instance, and they ran into issues, and then the issues were so big that they cannot afford to keep people working on it, because they were waiting for equipment to arrive. Yeah, and it takes 12 months, and then you're not going to pay a whole crew 12 months. So eventually these projects, they died, but they were in the startup phase. And then because they were so big, they didn't manage to go through this valley of death.
Mm.
So personally, I think, and that's where TNO can support you. You need to find a strategy that allows you to build something at a scale which is economically affordable. Maybe not making the big bucks, but a scale where you can de-risk and de-bottleneck your entire technology and still make a little bit of money so that you run it, not for 2 years, but for a few decades.
Yeah.
And then from that, you have something that you can scale up and earn your money with.
And within the Netherlands and within Europe, probably, do we have enough feedstock and different kinds of feedstock and the quality? Because de-risking is one of the things that you both talked about. And of course, if you want to switch to or add the biofuel to your existing fuels, you have to make sure and you have to know that the quality will be okay, and you have to rely on that the fuels will be there, of course. Is that all in place, or is that something that also has to be worked on?
Well, we, to confirm what Berend is saying, we need a first of kind plant now of new technology that will have to organize new types of feedstock supply chains. We need to learn. And so we basically, for this one plant, yes, there's enough. What we need not just one plant, we need a lot of plants. And then we still think there is enough. And that has a little bit to do with the fact that we don't need to replace all fossil fuels because we have got electrification kicking in.
Yeah.
We just need a strategic part. And that's for that strategic part, 20, you said 30%, 25%, depending a little bit on the modeling of TNO. So if you have this part, there is for this part enough feedstock available. The question is not so much the theoretical availability, but how are you going to mobilize these feedstock supply chains?
Yeah. And maybe to add to that, so that's also where TNO plays an important role with testing different feedstocks. Because if you talk about the fossil sector, you have natural gas, and you have a lot of it. So you build your plant on a single fuel, which is basically all year round the same. If you build a large plant, a gasification plant on municipal solid waste, then the composition will vary throughout the year. If you build it on agricultural residues, it will also vary. So the fluctuation in composition is much larger, and TNO has the capabilities to test all these feedstocks and give advice on how to operate your plant with this new feedstock and with the varying specs on the feedstock.
Yeah. It also sounds that there needs to be the production change the cooperation between all the stakeholders has to be invested in and has to be strengthened. Is that also something, Luz, that you are working on together with TNO?
Yeah, this is crucial. I think that this is crucial. It's not just one party that needs to step forward. You need a whole chain of parties to step forward. And I think this is exactly what we would like to collaborate with TNO. They have the capability to actually bring this whole system in the room and move together. And that's what you need. And what we believe, what I think is very strong with TNO, if we think about the new system, we need a lot of first of kind. We need to learn. And with TNO, we can learn. And with learning, we can go faster, because then you don't have to make the same mistakes again. You have already knowledge how to address these mistakes. Mm-hmm. So this is what I think is going to be the essential way why we would like to collaborate with TNO here.
Yeah. And how do you do that, Berend? How do you collaborate with all these? Because I think how you phrased it was very interesting, Luz, that you have to step forward together,
yeah,
all at the same time,
yeah,
which of course is very complicated because everybody has their own world that they're living in and has their own stakeholders and has their own targets that they have to meet. So quite complicated.
Well, it's maybe more complex than developing a technology, because you have to mobilize indeed the feedstock supply sector, which is a completely different sector than a gasification sector or a fuel sector at the end. And you have to bring them all together. And that's what we are currently trying to do, also together with Platform, in order to bring everybody together and find a common denominator where we see, okay, the reason why we come together is to advance biofuels. And everyone might have their own interest, but the main goal is to advance biofuels. Hmm. And if we're successful there, then I think we can really make these steps, make it happen.
Yeah. Luz, is there a sector that can benefit more from biofuels than others, where biofuels maybe even have a bigger value than in another sector?
That's an interesting question you ask, because in a way, the biofuels in road transport is a transition fuel. And I don't know how you look at it, but investing in a transition fuel is a bit of a bad business case, right? You are phasing it out already. So we would like to see it more as green molecules. And there is a lot of demand for green molecules. You can use it in the chemical sectors as a molecule. You can also use it to actually store it under the ground. And then you have a removal of CO2. And we believe that's going to be a very interesting proposition for society.
Okay, so it's also a CO2 capture device, as you could say.
A removal, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. All right.
Well, it's a CO2 capture device in the sense that you make molecules where CO2, which would otherwise be emitted, is stored. If it ends up in the chemical sector and it ends up in products, like if you make methanol and methanol to olefins, and from the olefins you make plastics, then you're storing biogenic CO2 as a plastic.
Yeah. As long as we don't burn the plastic afterwards.
As end of life, yeah. Yes. But at the same time, in most gasification processes, or all gasification processes based on biogenic feedstock, they will produce CO2. Because there's, in the feedstock itself, there's a surplus of oxygen. So part of it, if you don't have sufficient hydrogen, and part of it will come out as CO2. If you sequestrate the CO2, then your entire technology is producing negative emissions, and it's producing a replacement of a fossil fuel, methanol or kerosene or methane. So it works on two sides.
Yeah. Well, that makes it interesting. So you should have a bonus for the CO2 that you're capturing, instead of that you have to pay for your CO2 if you're using fossil fuels. But it has to work on two sides.
Yeah, yeah, this was a much better explanation indeed, but it's a vital point that we would like to address here. It's not just producing biofuels for a road sector demand. It also has, in some pathways, not all, a CO2 as a source. And then you can actually also create a carbon removal. And we believe if you have these two things together, then you can overcome maybe the problem of being a transition fuel, because you can also serve other societal needs.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, one of the biggest problems of the energy transition is that in the industry that needs very high temperatures, that in the aviation, when there's no other solution yet, this is, well, maybe everything is a transition something, because everything's changing, but it will probably not be a solution that will be in 20 or 30 years, we'll be having planes that are flying on batteries.
No, that one is one to stay for the time we can imagine for the time coming. Yes. Yeah. So for fuels for replacing the fossil kerosene in airplanes, renewable biofuels are extremely important.
Yeah. What do we have at the moment in the Netherlands? What are the things that are already happening? Where are we already making biofuels? Because it's the funny thing about biofuels is that they're already here.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. So help us, Luz.
Well, actually, we did an analysis and we saw that the Netherlands is one of the 8 largest countries producing biofuels globally.
Wow,
so
okay.
We're
leader in the world.
Almost.
Well,
yeah.
Almost. Well, not necessarily.
Brazil and the US maybe.
Brazil and
a bit bigger.
India are bigger perhaps. Yeah. But we are having a lot of facilities. I think Port of Rotterdam is having Neste, has Alco Group, Ethanol, HEFA, HVO, I don't know if you want to have any technical terms here. We have a lot of biomethane, also for the gas engines. We have FAME for biodiesel production, Argent Energies in Amsterdam. We have a lot of big facilities in this country.
Yeah, wow. Ben, do you have an example of one of the projects that you are working on at the moment to speed up and scale up this biofuel transition?
Yeah, we're currently part of a European consortium called Icarus. And in this project, we have defined 3 pathways to aviation fuel. One is via upgrading of bio-oils. One is via a sugar pathway, so sugar to alcohols and then alcohol to SAF. And the other one is via a syngas route. So that means gasification to produce syngas and then turn syngas into aviation fuel. And traditionally speaking, if you make aviation fuel from syngas, everybody in the field will talk about Fischer-Tropsch, which is mainly delivered into the market by Shell and Sasol. But this technology is based on a completely different premise, that the feedstock is abundantly available and consistent throughout the year. So it's either gas or coal, making it possible to go to very large scale plants to produce these fuels. And however, if you go to biomass, then you don't have that skill, at least not for the coming decades.
Yeah.
So you need to have an idea on how to do it on a smaller scale. And then the traditional Fischer-Tropsch technology, we identify as a weak link. So it will make the technology or the fuel very expensive, because the technology is expensive and you only earn it back if you have a large facility.
Yeah.
So what we look at in the project specifically is a pathway to aviation fuel, where you basically develop new catalytic approach to convert syngas into aviation fuel. So it's based on the traditional Fischer-Tropsch, but it has a somewhat different approach to it in order to avoid a lot of additional capex that you would normally need.
Yeah, and with the difference that the basis of where the energy comes from is totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, wow. Looking forward to the future, let's look into the future. What do you hope and dream of that biofuels, which role will it play in our energy system? So all the things that you both are working on, Loes and Berend, everything, all the energy that you are putting in it with all your colleagues has paid off. It worked. What happened? What changed? What does it look like?
Well, it has. I think it has contributed to the strategic autonomy of Europe.
Okay.
I think with this kind of, especially also what Berend says, this is a pathway we very much support. We actually can actually make our own fuels. We're going to be independent from value chains from overseas. Doesn't need to be. We can also still import, but we have the opportunity to also have our own fuel production, and we believe that's a very strong point. And with that own production, you use your own feedstocks. You create a strong situation for Europe in its own production, and then you create also the start of the supply chains for the chemical sectors here in Europe. So this would be basically how we look at the future. It will empower Green Europe.
Wow.
Yeah, and from my perspective, if you look into the Netherlands, there's a lot of gasification technology being developed. For instance, Torgas, RWE, Gidara, Sinova, Perpetual Next, they are all working on technology, gasification technology, to convert solid feedstocks into high-value products, fuels or chemicals. And I dream of a future where these technologies are deployed, but also that they become the new basis of an industrial cluster like we have had before in the Eemshaven and in the Rotterdam harbor, where you basically on a fossil fuel, you build an entire industrial complex. And since a gasification technology operating on biomass or residues will provide also synthesis gas, which can be turned into methane, into olefins, into methanol. So you could develop a similar industrial complex, only if also policy is in place and the politics, policymakers, they see this dream as well, that they see, okay, we need to diverge away from fossil fuel, so reduce the consumption there. We need to build up a new industry, and gasification can be a technology which is very versatile in this sense, and can serve all these different markets, so the fuel, energy, chemicals.
Wow, a new industrial cluster.
Several industrial clusters.
And autonomy for Europe. Well, these are big dreams. So thank you very much. Thanks for all your knowledge and your wisdom, Loes Knotter from Platform Renewable Fuels and Berend Vreugdehil from TNO. Thank you both. And thank you, of course, for watching or listening to this podcast. There are more podcasts that you can listen to or videos that you can watch. Go to tno.nl and have fun listening and viewing all these beautiful information.